My name is Walt Walton, and I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is February the 13th of 1976. I want to tell you a little bit about that before we get started. We're talking about hair standing up on arms. In January of 1976, the man who was to 12-step me in this program and become my first sponsor arrived in Memphis, Tennessee on a Greyhound bus, 5 years sober, from Jacksonville, Florida, stone broke. Milton, somehow or another, Renee had his phone number and called him, and Milton took the time and effort and reached in his pocket with a $20 bill to help Renee Towsley. About 3 weeks later, Renee Towsley and I met. And my miracle happened the day we met. I got here as a direct result of one alcoholic talking to another one, but I also got here as a direct result of a sober alcoholic reaching out his hand to help us another sober alcoholic. So I've never told Milton this, and Joanne both, you know, how much they both have meant to me in my sobriety, because I realize that possibly my life may have hinged on whether Milton made that trip to that bus station. But I don't know about you, and I don't really know if this is the truth or not, but I believe it. That I believe that there's somebody somewhere for every one of us that can lay this deal down where we can pick it up. And Renee Towsley was the man that could put it down where I could pick it up. There may have been a million other people trying to do that, and I might have never, ever understood it. I want to thank you so much from the bottom of my heart for asking me here. It's my second trip. The last time was in November, and it was a little on the nippy side. My wife was with me, Neva, and she sends her love and regrets that she's unable to make the trip. Her health's not the best in the world, but hopefully the next time we show up here, she'll be with me. I've been looking for something in the 12 and 12 for the past 3 or 4 weeks, and I was firmly convinced that it was on in the sixth step. And Charles came in the room while ago and he said, "What are you looking for?" I said, "I'm looking for a passage in the sixth step that I can't find it." He said, "What is it?" And I said, "Well, it talks about someone of the opposite sex finding a mate that they are physically, mentally, spiritually, and emotionally connected." That's not the exact words. Charles said, "Well, Walt, that's in step 12. And I thought to myself, how does he know that? He said he's been doing a lot of reading in the last 18 years, and I believe him. I want to tell you tonight about the little gal that's not here with me tonight. She's exactly like that step describes her, our relationship today. And I can't tell you how grateful I am to both the fellowships that we have that. She started going to Al-Anon in 1979 because I was going to about 10 meetings a day. She didn't need to be there. Her former husband died of chronic alcoholism, and it kind of runs a little rampant in her family, but she came because we had an understanding in August of 1979. And I told her at that time, I said, "Unless I go absolutely insane, I said, this deal is always going to come before you children, job, whatever. And if you can't handle this, we don't need to go any further in our plans for a marriage. So she started coming to Al-Anon, and I want to tell you tonight, it's still the first thing in my life. Because without this program, this fellowship, and you, I hadn't had a drink in over 28 years. And the beautiful part about that is most of that 28 and a half years has been completely without the desire to drink. It's one thing not to drink, but it's something else to not to want to drink. And that's what you've given me. I got drunk the first time when I was 14 years old. And, you know, they asked me at my class reunion. I went back over there about 10 years ago, and you know how things are when you do that. Word gets out. There was an Al-Anon there that I had attended a couple of these deals with, and somehow the word got out that I was in AA. And it goes back again to perception. The longer I live, the more I realize how important that word is. And they asked me, they said, when did you start drinking, Walt? I said, when I was 14. And they all kind of looked at each other. There was a group of about 15 or 20 people gathered in this home before the reunion officially started. And they said, why did you do that? And I said, because I wanted to feel like you looked. And they all kind of laughed. And I said, what's so funny? They said, we've discussed this a million times, that we thought that if anyone in that class had it made, it was you. I didn't see me that way. And I really can't understand anybody else seeing me that way. So, you know, I've got to tell you this before I can look out here in this room tonight, and this is the most humbling experience for me in whatever I do in AA, is to come here, first of all, to be asked to come here. And secondly, to stand in a room where there's obviously many more qualified people to do what I'm doing. You know, I heard Bo and Shirley's story last night and today, and as they talked about the tragedy in their recovery with the loss of a child, and some physical problems with another child, I couldn't help but think about a line that Johnny Harris has used a million times. God, excuse me, gives big crosses to big horses and little crosses to little horses like me. I can't imagine having to go through that. But I know one thing. If I stay close to you, if I stay close to you, I can walk through anything that happens in my life. After that first drunk, it was on some cheap wine, and I drank for all of it I could pretty quick at that time, the best friend I'd ever had in my life. And I felt fantastic for about 10 minutes. And I had my first near-death experience for the next 3 days after that. So intelligence, you know, I learned right away, anybody's got any brains at all would have looked at just the two time frames. 10 minutes of feeling good, almost 72 hours of damn near dying. You wouldn't do it again. The whole time that I was trying to keep from dying, there was a thought in the back of my mind, wonder when I'm going to get to do this again. And as soon as I got able to do it again, I did it again. I told Charles today, I went to sleep out here on this park bench this afternoon. Took a nice little nap, breeze was blowing. And right before I dozed off, I thought about other benches that I've gone to sleep on and under. I guarantee entirely different, different conditions. What a blessing it is to lay down out here and go to sleep and And Bo said, be safe to be surrounded by you. There's something about this place. This is my second trip here. Every place I go in AA has got a special feel. This place, I sat in this room last night and this morning, and I'm a true believer in this. All the good talks that have been made here, all the sharing that's been done in this facility over the years, I got a feeling they left it here, a lot of it. If they didn't, I feel it when I come in here. It's almost a tangible thing to me. But I come in here and I sit out here, I look at y'all, I'm going to tell you something, just to be perfectly honest with you. At about 5 or 6 years sober, I somehow got the idea that I was going to be the second coming of Clancy. I just absolutely knew that I was going to be one of them overwhelming, dynamic, sock it to you AA speakers. I guess you've noticed already, it never did quite come off. It never quite happened. Phone call came. I'll get back to the drunk part of my life in a minute. I may cry a little bit. If that bothers you, I'm sorry. It doesn't bother me. I never cried till I came in this fellowship. Couldn't afford to. Could not afford to do that. I'm lost. First drunk, I can sum it up with this. I got drunk the first time I drank, and I got drunk the last time I drank. And a lot of good things, a lot of bad things happened from the time I was 14 until I was 42 years of age. My wife, we moved back to her hometown in Tupelo, Mississippi. And when we moved there, y'all know how them small towns are, and she was a little hesitant about the first time I talked there. She said, let me ask you a question. Is it going to be necessary for you to talk about the penitentiary and the nut house in my hometown? And I said, I'm afraid so. That's the last thing she said to me when I left home yesterday morning. Are you going to have to talk about the penitentiary and the nut house? I got to do a little of it. They had me in that puzzle factory when I was 18 years old. I felt like that I was probably a cut above the other patients, inmates, or whatever they chose to call it, because they only had me in there for observation. The rest of those people, they'd already decided they were crazy, but they were only going to observe me for 30 days. And at the end of their observation, they decided that I had some grave emotional and mental disorders. But you know, the unique thing about that is that I sit across the desk from a very competent psychiatrist 2 days a week for a month, and we talked about everything from my childhood to my current time in life. Never, ever mentioned alcohol. See, I was 18 years old. This was in 1953, somewhere along there. I didn't recognize it as a problem, and he probably thought I was probably a little too young for it. So we never touched on any of that. By the time I was 25 years old, now there were some good things happened in between. I got married when I was 19 years old, and that could be a story in itself, but it involves my ex-wife, and I don't really feel free to tell it. We got married at St. Peter's Catholic Church at 3rd and Poplar in downtown Memphis by the Reverend Snyder. Had a big church wedding. I drank a half a pint of vodka behind the rectory before I went in there. It's the last thing in the world I wanted to do the day that I did it. But you see, there was no pregnancy involved, so don't get your wheels turning in your head. There was none of that involved at all. But I want to tell you something. There was a situation involved in our life that I felt partially responsible for, and we got married, and we were separated shortly after that for about 6 months after that for 2.5 years. And my allegiance to that marriage lasted probably 90 days, and it continued to be terrible for the next 25 years, even into sobriety. So sometime after that, in the late 50s or early 60s, I was running with a bunch of people that I really did like the way they lived. I liked the way they moved and operated. And they seemed to have the funds to do everything that I didn't have. And I used to refer this to as my gangster era in my life. But I wasn't anything but a thief. Now you can flower it up, and I've been guilty of kind of buttering it up a little bit, being a little mysterious about my associates. And they were pretty mysterious people. We did a lot of harm to a lot of people, and I've taken care of that through this program. But anyway, the time came when the federal authorities decided I needed to put on a pair of bracelets, a belly chain, and some leg irons and take a little trip with them. And I did. And I received the benefit at that time. They had just passed a statute in the federal penal system that if you were a first offender, that you were eligible for parole any time after your sentencing date. And John may recall this judge, his name was Marion Boyd, and he had a reputation of handing out extremely harsh sentences to everybody. I'll tell you how much he frightened me. I'd already made him pretty angry in some pretrial things that were going on at the arraignment. He asked me if I had an attorney, and I told him yes, and I showed up 3 days before we were supposed to go to trial without one, and got the continuance that he did not want to give us, and he was extremely angry with me. Told me that the next time that I appeared in this courtroom, if I didn't have an attorney, he was going to add a contempt charge to the already 16-count indictment that I was facing at that time. But I'll tell you how frightened I was and how necessary it was for me to take a drink. I stood in the hallway of that federal court building the morning of my sentencing and drank a pint of whiskey, standing in front of his courtroom door, because it was necessary for me to take a drink. Went in there and I got sentenced out of that deal, did a year in a federal correctional institution, joined the Catholic Church for real, did real well there, was a good convict. I learned real early how to walk that line, how to satisfy the inmates you lived with and make the people that ran that institution happy, both sides of the fence. Came out of there and I changed my actions, but my thinking stayed pretty much the same. Stayed sober for about 90 days and I was off and running again. And I continued to do that. And my experience in Nashville, Tennessee had come some of it before that, but some of it after that. I left Memphis with a wife and 2 children, staying with her father, with a cardboard suitcase and $3.75 or $3.80 in my pocket, and I was traveling the way I really knew how to travel with that thumb in there. Interstate 40 was not completed to Nashville all the way, and I'm out there hooking them. Got to Nashville. Year later, I'm the general manager at one of the larger Ford dealerships in the metropolitan area of Nashville. So, you know, like most alcoholics, I got something in. There's something in us that we can go to 0 to 100 quick, but I could also go from 100 to 0 the same way. And there was a period in my life that material things started coming my way there, and my alcoholism really accelerated during that period of time. I was making a lot of money. I got to tell you this. I swear, have you noticed lately on all the TV, the talking heads on TV and TV shows, everybody's saying, I have to tell you this, or I must tell you this, or I got to tell you this. I sat down there in the room tonight, and I said, I hope I don't get up there and say, I got to tell you this. I'm sick of hearing that. Got to Nashville, and good times, bad times. I am going to tell you this. It was about that time that I started experiencing some problems with some outside issues that we don't discuss, and I'm not going to go into it here tonight, but it's part of my story. And I took them every day for 7 years. They helped me drink a lot more. And you know, it's just that simple. I could take that drug and drink everybody in here under the table. So I took them all day long because I said, you know, I don't drink on the job. But I stayed under the influence of that drug during the daylight hours, and then at night I'd have to drink a quart of whiskey to get back down where I could live. And that went on a day at a time for about 7 years. All good things come to an end, and that came to an end, and I moved to another town. It was a struggle. Things started getting better. I kept taking me with me, though, and everywhere I went, things would get good, and then they'd get bad. And that's the way alcohol, I put that drug down more or less in 1969, returned to it occasionally, but it wasn't that way with the booze. 1969 rolled around, and things were looking better in my life. You judged me for my outsides. At that time, you'd think Walt's doing pretty good. He's got 2 children, one in Christian Brothers High School, the other one over at IC on Central Avenue. He's got a job. The police are not looking for him. His bills are all current. See, none of that other stuff, sleeping on them benches or being in those other 2 places that I mentioned, or any of the horrible things that happened to me that should have brought me to a bottom that I would have been receptive to come here, didn't faze me. The last 7 years that I drank, I had become everything that I detested in everybody else. And I don't care how much I drink, it wouldn't change it. It would not change it. So I got up every morning for 7 years chasing that drink that was going to make me feel like it does in chapter 11 in the big book. Most normal folks. Finding conviviality, you know, the whole deal. Release from care, boredom, and worry. I hate to tell you this, I studied that book for 10 or 12 years before I made the connection from that page to the next page. That book describes things so well for me. There's no way to try to elaborate on the words in that book. There's no room for improvement. Release from care, boredom, and worry. That's why I drank. On the following page, it says, we realize that we're going to have to stop drinking. But are we going to be consigned to a life of being stupid, boring, and glum? Like some righteous people I see. Well, see, that's exactly what sobriety looked like to me. I'd leave out there in the neighborhood I lived in at that time, Parkway Village, if I ran out of whiskey for some reason or other, which didn't happen often, but it did. And I'd get in my car and I'd go to Bumpsy's down there off of Crump and Porter. Some of y'all may know where Bumpsy's was if you drank in Memphis during that era. And you could go down there and buy you some whiskey on Sunday. I would pass people in my neighborhood that were mowing yards, hooking boats up, had their kids all spit shine, going to church, doing all the things that people do that I enjoy doing today. And I looked at those people and I thought, my God, how do they live that way? That's what sobriety looked like to me. So stupid, boring, and glum is what it looked like. Then the book says, do you have a substitute for this? You know, and the book says, yeah, and it's vastly more than that. He said, you'll find it in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. So there, listen real close if you've never connected this. It took me about 12 years. There you will find release from care, boredom, and worry. So if you're new in this program, you're wondering what you're going to get here. You're going to get exactly what we were chasing in that jug. But you don't have to throw these steps up every morning. And I've never been locked up for going to an AA meeting. So that's what's happened in my life. The sufficient substitute that that book talks about has occurred in my life as of today. There's a lot of other bad things and funny things and a lot of stuff that I could talk. I'd really like to talk to you tonight about what's happened to me since the last time I saw you, since the last time I stood in this room. I read Chuck Chamberlain's book in 1985 at a friend of mine's house in Tulsa, Oklahoma, who later took his life with 13 years sobriety. He was a giver. If I live to be 200 years old, I'll never be able to give back what Gene Lott gave to this fellowship in the 13 short years that he was with us. But things happened in his life that he couldn't tolerate, and he took his life. He spent a week in my home before he did it, and we discussed the possibility of him doing that. The last time I saw him, he got in his car in my driveway in Tupelo, Mississippi, and was headed back to Tulsa. And we hugged, and I told him, before you do it, pick up the phone, call me. Just the same thing we do if you're going to take a drink. He called from Dallas, Texas. He called from Oklahoma City. Called from another small town in Kansas, telling me it was getting worse by the day. What he was doing was making the rounds of his real close friends to tell them goodbye. Went home at that beautiful place of his on top of a mountain just south of Tulsa, Oklahoma. Pulled the garage door down and took his life. That made me awfully angry for a long time about that. But I picked that book up in his home in 1985, and I was absolutely about as miserable as I've ever been in my sobriety, because you see, I loved Tulsa, Oklahoma. The little blue-eyed Indian I'm married to was born and raised in northeast Mississippi, and she had been homesick every moment that she lived in that town. So, you know, I finally said, well, I'll do something for you, and we'll go to Tupelo. And I can't tell you, I did it with a lot of grace. I was awfully angry, and I kept creating reasons to go back to Tupelo. I was involved in one of the most exciting times in my sobriety. And I wish to God that we could do it in our community today, but I don't know. Maybe it will happen. There were about 8 or 10 of us, Gene Lott, the guy that I mentioned including, put together a little AA program that was very attractive to teenage children. And on a Saturday night, we'd have 250 kids in that room, all of them getting sober. We had their mothers and fathers and brothers and sisters in those rooms. And here I'm being jerked out of this to come to Tupelo, Mississippi. I'm not a real happy guy. First of all, I knew that I was probably going to just go stone broke. I said, there's no... So see, I still had that picture of Mississippi in my mind. And got there, and the day I left Tulsa, Oklahoma, if you'd asked me, is there anything in your life you'd like to change, I would have told you, don't touch it. If you asked me today about Tupelo, Mississippi, is there anything you'd like to change, I'd tell you to leave it alone. See, this program works in spite of me. It works in spite of me. I've made every mistake that you can make in Alcoholics Anonymous, with the exception of two things. I have never disagreed with the first 164 pages of this big book in it. I have found nothing there that I can disagree with or object to, and I've never picked up a drink. Everything else that those of you who have been around this deal for a while know the mistakes that can be made in here, and I'm not proud of some of them. Somewhere between 8 years probably, I assumed a role. I was a deputy AA sheriff. I was not a full-fledged sheriff, however I felt like I was qualified to be, because I could walk into your group and take a group inventory in about 5 minutes and tell you what you're doing wrong. I could look at a new guy or a new gal coming in the program and tell you whether they belonged in there or not. thank you for what you said. And then I finally, I was a full-blown sheriff there for a while. At about 10 years, I turned my sheriff badge in and resigned and just became another drunk. And things have gotten a lot better. The book talks to me about the spiritual malady. It talks about when the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. I've had some people kind of disagree. Said, "Oh no, so you got to get your body." The book says that when the spiritual malady is overcome, then I straighten out up here and in here. That's exactly what happened. It took me almost 9 years for that to happen. Without a drink, going to a lot of meetings. I have a home group. I forgot to mention that's the 12 and 12 group in Tupelo, Mississippi. I have a sponsor who is incapacitated with some kind of problem. He's been that way for over a year. But I've surrounded myself with three young men back here tonight, for one thing, that know me pretty dadgum good. And I don't know what I'm going to do with that deal, but anyway, that's the way it is. But I'm doing all the right things, and I'm still doing a lot of things wrong. And I never had gotten quite comfortable with God. You know, I could see Him working in my life every day and in your lives. And I'm going to tell you where my higher power, my understanding of God as I understand Him came from. It came from watching us. John and Mary would go out and come back and say, "This is the 85th time, and I'm back." I've never heard one of us, and I hope to God I never do, hear them say, "John or Mary, 85 was the limit. You can't come back. You tried it one time too many." All I've ever heard or seen was, "Come on in, get a cup of coffee, welcome back." And I watched that over a period of years. This was not a conscious decision I made. It just occurred to me one day that if a bunch of self-centered, egotistical lunatics, like most of my friends are or have been, could be that loving toward one another, then how much could God really love me? And I got the spiritual malady for me was overcome about that time. It was about that time that I went to work on a job, and I stayed there for 15 years. That may not impress you at all, but for someone who usually lasted about 15 days, it really impresses me. I gave the man a good day's work for a good day's pay. He paid me extremely well. I stayed there 15 years, and I came up here during that period of time. He is like every other employer that I've had since I've been in this fellowship, knows who I am. They know as much about my stories as you know tonight. All of them have known it. I did not want to go to work. Yeah, I've had one of two of them ask me, "Why are you telling me this?" I said, "I don't want to come to work someday and hear you on the PA system telling me to come to your office and me wonder why you want me to." I want it up front. I will tell you this much, that being an alcoholic and being where you know I've been, because I just got through telling you, has never, ever hindered me in my opportunity to have a better life. Ever. So, you know, I don't have a lot of patience with people from time to time. So, well, there's no way for me because look at my record. Look at mine. I've never had an employer tell me, you know, I had one tell me, he said, "You know, I was thoroughly convinced I was going to hire you this morning when we did this interview, but that, in light of what you told me, I'm going to have to give it a little more thought." And I said, "You'd be crazy if you didn't." 2 days later, he called me and I went to work for him. But I'm going to take you back to 1976 in Milton, loaning Renee Towsley $20 and giving him a place to stay overnight and him going to work. And me showing up to work there at the same place at the same time. He was about that tall, and he was from Cleveland, Ohio. And like most of them people that I felt about at that time, he had a rather abrasive personality. He took one look at me. I weighed 280 pounds. He weighed about 110 fully clothed, and we were a remarkable pair for a long time together. He and I went to breakfast that morning. The first day we met, he stopped and had some breakfast out there on Summer Avenue. And I said, "I'm going on up the road a little further." He said, "Where are you going?" I said, "I'm going up here and get me a pork chop. They don't serve them in here." And he went in and ate, and I went up the road and got me a half pint of Old Charter. Looks about like a nice-sized pork chop. That's what I called them. And came back, and he watched me drink that half pint of whiskey. He watched me do this for about 2 or 3 weeks every day. Never said a word to me about it. Never told me he was an Alcoholics Anonymous. Never mentioned any of that stuff to me. There's something that goes between us without us ever even saying anything to. When I was with this guy, I kind of felt at ease. And when he was away from me, I was uneasy. So he started disappearing at noon a lot, and he disappeared 3 or 4 nights a week at 7:30 or 8 o'clock we were working together. And everybody seemed to be okay with it, the employer was. I got real curious about where he was going, and finally asked him, I said, "Where do you go every day at noon?" And I noticed you disappear from here 3 or 4 nights a week. And he looked at me and he said, "It's none of your damn business where I go." Well, that didn't sit too well. But there was something about this guy that was different from anybody I'd ever been close to. He continued to do that. Finally, I cornered him one day. I said, "You as well tell me where you're going, man, because I ain't giving up to you today." He said, "Walt, I'm going to tell you something." He said, "This time around, see, my first sponsor came in our fellowship in 1947. He had the tremendous gift of giving this program away, had a very difficult time keeping it for himself. He said, "I've got about coming up on 6 years sober, and I go to Alcoholics Anonymous and I don't drink a day at a time." I said, "The most dreaded thing I think an alcoholic can say at that moment." I looked at him and I said, "You know, I may have a drinking problem myself." And he looked at me and his reply really startled me. He said, "No, big job, I don't think you've drank near enough yet." Well, I did a little calculation and I said, "Well, you know, I had my first one about 8 this morning. I'm going to probably take my last one somewhere around 10 tonight." And I'm thinking, how does he figure I'm going to increase this? And he looked at me and he said, "Now, I know what you're thinking." He said, "You got some pretty decent clothes." He said, "They look like hell on you, but they're pretty decent clothes." And he said, "You got a wife and a couple of kids and a job." He said, "You need to really kind of get after it." He said, "You know where Jimmy Stroud's mission is down on 3rd Poplar?" I said, "Sure I do." He said, "You need to get down there on that bottle gang behind that mission for about a year and then come back to me and tell me about your damn drinking problem." Well, see, you know, being the good alcoholic that I am, I already knew he had several little hot buttons that he didn't particularly like either. He was a small guy, and he was old. He looked old to me at that time. He's younger than I am now. And I called him a little old man. I said, "A little old man, let me tell you something, I can't quit." That really shocked me when I said that. And he said, "You know, your problem may be a little more serious than I thought it was." He said, "I'm going to make you a deal." He said, "I'm going to a meeting here in about 30 minutes. And he said, "You ain't going." He said, "Because you're already drinking today." He said, "I want you to finish whatever your quota is for the day." And he said, "Don't drink Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and I'll consider taking you to a meeting Monday." Didn't promise to take me or urge me to go. He just said he'd consider taking me. Well, I went home that night. I had my last drink on February the 12th on a Thursday, somewhere between 9 o'clock and midnight. I already had my quota in me, but I thought, if this is going to be the finish of this deal, I might ought to have a little more. So, you know, I was pretty good at doing this. I sent someone after another pint of whiskey to Tony Cianciola's store down there on Perkins. and got me another pint and got it down. Got up the next morning, got to work. I didn't have a big problem. I was drunk till 2 o'clock the next afternoon from what I drank the night before. Then the wheels started getting a little wobbly. Saturday got really kind of funny. I'm trying to work and talk to people, and I'm crazy. It'd been 7 years since I had gone without a drink. You know, I hear people talk about detoxing today, and I guess probably I should have done it. But I didn't know anything about it, and apparently he didn't either. So Sunday got really bad. I mean, it got really bad. And had a house full of whiskey. And every time I'd look at a jug, I'd see that little Yankee looking back at me. And I said, I'm not going to give that sucker the satisfaction to drink. See, God was doing something for me then a long time before I even knew to ask him for it. So the one that I got today will help me. I don't even have to ask him. Sometimes he'll just step in and help me, realizing what a dummy I am and I need some unasked for help. He helped me then. I went to work Monday. He took one look at me and he said, you made it, didn't you? And I said, yeah, I never did. I don't know how he knew that, but he did. Yeah, I said, yeah, I made it, and I'm ready to go to a meeting. He said, you're going to have to wait till noon. So we went to the Clark Tower building over on Poplar on the 14th floor. Got off the elevator, and it's been mentioned by Bo and Shirley, the most spiritual thing that we do for each other in this fellowship, for me, may not be for you, is when we share our laughter together. I got off the elevator at the 14th floor of that Clark Tower, and before we got around the corner, all I could hear was laughter. And it had a different ring to it. And the different ring to our laughter is, it's never at anyone's expense. See, there's a lot of laughter in them old joints I used to go to, but it was always somebody was at the butt end of that laughter. There was always somebody getting put down, cut up, or something. This was a pure sound. First time I ever heard it sounded as pure as that bell that you rang tonight. We walked down the hall, walked in as a conference room, probably designed to seat maybe 15 people. There was about twice that many in there. You know, we met in funny places. The places we met in and still meet in were never designed for a lot of smoke. The ventilation systems were never, no, I don't think anybody ever anticipated 30 people in there smoking 2 cigarettes at a time. But that's what they were doing. They were drinking coffee, and there I stood, and I had that pretty bourbon tan. I was about the color of that little wheelbarrow back there. And there he stood. I'm 280 pounds of dazzling footwork, speed, and action. There he stood, leading me in like some dummy. And we sat down. They had a beginner's meeting. I sat there and cried during the whole hour. And they told me it was okay. It embarrassed me. But that has not bothered me today. I cried the first 3 years I was in AA. I've almost done it 2 or 3 times tonight. But we got out of that meeting, and I felt different. I guess I'm one of them AA freaks. According to Clancy, I am. Milton and Joanne in the Traditions group had Clancy there for an anniversary 10 or 15 years ago in Memphis. And I'd heard him say this a million times in talks, but I never met anybody that said, I found AA, thank God I'm home. You know, he makes some reference to that time to time. And I told him that night, I said, you can never truthfully say that again, Clancy. Because that's exactly the way I felt the first meeting I walked into. Thank God. There was something there. It's never left me. I don't know when the desire to drink left me, but I have a feeling that I know that the compulsion and that overwhelming just got to have it left me that day. The first time I was exposed to you. We left there that day, went back to work. He said, good things happen to drunks that don't drink. I got some friends in here in the same business that I'm in, and when you're in the car business and you're not doing real well, people refer to it as you're on a slick spot. And I was on kind of a slick spot. I hadn't sold anything in a few days, and was trying to quit drinking and all this stuff was going on. Got out of the car. He said, "Why don't you wait on that guy over there?" Ordinarily, I would have looked at him and said, "Hey, he couldn't buy a car at Walmart." You know, that was just the kind of attitude I had. Walked over to him. He said, "How much is it?" I told him. He said, "I'll take it," and started pushing money at me. And I thought, man, he knows what he's talking about. Good things have it. Drunks that don't drink. That night, that Monday night, pretty sure it was that same night, Milton and Joanne know more than I do. I walked in the traditions group, did not know this. I didn't know how much trouble my future sponsor was in his life. I mean, he'd come out of a place washing dishes in Jacksonville, Florida, stone, but yet he was unselfish enough to take up this time with me. I didn't realize how young the traditions group was until I got to studying the history of it. I walked in the door. Of course, I don't recall ever seeing Milton prior to that, but I had seen Joanne a number of times. Matter of fact, we'd hoisted a few together. And I took a look at her and I said, "Hell, she's in AA." Come to find out, she's going in that other room. Milton and that group of people, Charlie Chambers, and just, I can't remember all their names, but thank God they were there. Thank God I have been blessed. I've been surrounded since day one with excellent sobriety. Since day one, I've been provided people, one person at a time, sometimes two or three of you at a time, that were putting this program to work in your life. You surround yourself with that kind of people in this fellowship, and there's absolutely no way to fail. There's not too many things I'll tell you that are absolute, but that's one of them. You cannot fail if you come here and surround yourself with good sobriety and follow these simple instructions. It's impossible for it not to work. Well, that started this journey, and I'd been married that time, you know, 22 years, had almost grown children. Anyway, got a divorce a little while later, and just felt terrible about doing that because she'd been a very good wife to me. But you know, we found out really that we didn't even really like each other. And I believe this. I don't know it for sure. I think had I stayed in that marriage, I wouldn't be standing here tonight. I think I'd have probably died drunk. You know, that marriage was filled with insanity, infidelity, drinking, just the worst I could do. I did the very worst I could do. I've been in this marriage for a long time. That program of Alcoholics Anonymous has changed me. And I'm going to tell you something. I have not gone along with some of these changes without a little resistance from time to time. I used to say I had a lot of trouble with women. But women had a lot of trouble with me, is what really happened. It's, you know, when I make this statement to you today that I've been in this marriage for nearly 25 years and I've been faithful to this marriage, I've been faithful to what I said I'd do, astounds me. I owe it all to you. Owe every bit of it to you. 1985, my wife started having some bronchial problems. I'm a 3-pack-a-day smoker. Been that way since I was 15 years old, when I could get them. You know, they say if you got them, smoke them, and I sure smoked them when I had them. Doctor suggested that she stop smoking. God bless her. She'd have drank with me. She's never seen me take a drink. She'd have drank with me. She'd have died drunk. Because everything I do, she's going to do it. She smoked a pack of cigarettes a month when we met. She was smoking 2 packs a day when I stopped. I stopped to help her stop. Got up in the first morning, asked God. Felt a little wimpy about it. Asking God not to smoke doesn't seem to have quite the punch that asking him not to drink does. I thought, boy, this is a lightweight problem to be taken to God. You ought to be able to handle this yourself. asked him to help me not to smoke that day. About a week later, the desire to smoke left me and been back. I can stand here and tell you miracle after miracle has occurred in my life. I've got a son who will be celebrating if he doesn't get drunk between now and July, and I don't think he will because he's surrounded with very good sobriety in this fellowship. He's about to go through a very trying time. He's about to experience a divorce after about 13 years of marriage. I've got a daughter that I have not seen. I'm within a three-hour drive of her, and I hadn't seen her in 13 or 14 years. She went to treatment at Memphis Outreach on Lamar Avenue, and I went there almost every day and supported her while she was there. And she got out, and the last time we met, we had dinner together, and I said, I'll see you tomorrow at the Tower Noon meeting. And she didn't show up. And she went back to doing exactly what she was doing before she went to that treatment program. I'm going to tell you something, guys. I listened to Bo and Shirley's stories, and I've got a child that's doing her best to be as crazy as her daddy was. But thank God that those two chapters that you referred to in that big book are in there. The family afterward, and the chapter to the wives. I've been to big book studies where they just say, well, we'll skip over this. I'm going to tell you what, you get to look at yourself through another pair of glasses in them two chapters in that book. So anyway, she got out of that deal, and I've had phone calls at 2 o'clock in the morning from friends of hers. You're going to have to come get April out of jail. I said, no, I don't have to do that, and I'm not going to. We've talked on the phone a half a dozen times. And the conversation will go pretty well, and you know, we both know when it should end. I said, I'm probably going to try to start telling you what to do here in a few minutes, and I know you don't want to hear it, so we as well end the deal, and we do. But I'm going to tell you where she is in her life. Her brother's coming up on 7 years. Her daddy's got 28 years. Her favorite aunt has got 48 years of sobriety in this program in Miami, Florida. Her favorite cousin has got 21 years. She's surrounded with the solution. And I'm going to steal a line from our friend, the late Jim Williams. If she lives, we'll get her. I firmly believe that. But I cannot force it on her. And thank God, with your help, I hadn't tried to. The book's pretty clear to me about this. That, you know, don't ruin a future chance with somebody by trying to cram this thing down their throat. And I've been able to not do that. But it's a difficult thing. When I remember her as a 3 or 4 year old child, she's the most beautiful young girl I ever saw in my life. Naturally, she would be. She was my child. And when I think about her and what she's doing, and I remember that little girl, I have a hard time with it. But if I can remember who she is and what she is today, it's not nearly as painful. Well, she's a grown woman driven by a disease that's incurable and fatal. But it can be taken care of, put in remission on a daily basis, one day at a time, just like all of us have. The year 2000 comes along, and I gave my employer a year's notice about my resignation. He was gracious enough to accept that as a working deal. Somewhere during the middle of that year, I had a change of heart. He didn't. And I went to him, told him, I said, you know, I had gotten a lot of energy back, and the business that we're in, you know, is just a 6-day-a-week deal. I mean, the deal I was in, 10, 12 hours a day, is not because that I was any smarter than. It's the nature of the job, the function that I had within that business that required me to be there. So about halfway through that year, I said, you know, I think I've probably got another couple of years in me. He said, we've already made some other plans. And he says, as a matter of fact, we want your recommendation about two people. And they allowed me to recommend the guy to take my place on that job. Well, I left there, and the last day at work was just another day at work. They didn't trot out any bands. There wasn't any big cake, fireworks. No one came by and wailing and crying and gnashing the teeth. It's just, we locked up. Hell, I went home after 15 years. And I was angry. I was hurt. How could they do this to me? Now, this man had been paying me over in this pretty good six-figure money for 15 years, and I'm angry at him. He was the type of guy I had to go by and make some amends to him after I'd been gone for a couple of years. Told him, I said, I really need to tell you this. Thank you for all the times that I forgot whose name was on the sign here. And you allowed me to do it. He said, you forgot him a lot of times, Walt. He said, but you, and every time you forgot whose name was on that sign, it was always for the betterment of this corporation, and I know that. Left there, and we sold a house and got out of the yard business, thank God. I'm sitting in a house that was 45 years old, and I got to think about that 45-year-old plumbing underneath it. And we sold it and bought a condominium, and that took me about 4 months. I didn't want to completely quit working. I'd been exposed to the auction business back in the late 50s, and I liked it, and I did it from time to time throughout the years. I want to tell you something else about the world as I perceive it and I experience it today. I was 70 years old in January. Here again, my record in penal institutions, mental institutions, and now being 70 years old in a very young workforce has never impeded me whatsoever. I look back over my life, and I was not a person that you should have been very kind to or you would even want to extend any courtesy or kindness to. When I take an inventory of my life, drinking and sober, I am absolutely humbled by the fact of how well the human race has treated me. Down to prison guards, psychiatric hospital attendants, employers, other drunks, a lot of bad people that I was involved with. Been treated, it's amazing how well I've been treated in my life. And it's amazing to me that I went through a lot of those years moaning how bad things were and how bad people were treating me. The book's very clear to me about what my problem was. I could no longer differentiate the true from the false. The spiritual malady was overcome, and I'm starting to see some truth and understand it and know it for being the truth. I was on the way to Little Rock, Arkansas to call on a guy about a job. He told me if I ever retired from what I was doing and wanted to go to work in the auction industry to come see him. I stopped in Memphis on the way there to talk to an old friend of mine that I'd known for years, and his boss asked me what I was doing there, and I told him, and he hired me. I'll be there 4 years. Matter of fact, this month I'll be there 4 years. I work with people half my age. They have embraced me and taken me in. And I'm going to tell you something, guys. I've watched this happen. When I went to work there, this was not a conscious effort for me. There's 280 or 90 employees at this place. And when I went to work, I just started going back through the body shop, cleanup shops, upholstery shops. We do it all. Installation of windshields and saying, good morning, how are you, to almost every employee there. And I did it. It was no conscious effort. This program brought that out of me. So I can't tell you when I walk into work today what a joy it is to be there, what a joy it is to go to work with these guys. They don't treat me like I'm an old guy. They treat me like I'm one of their own in their peer group. They come to me and ask me about things. One of them told another day, he said, he says he has absolutely no education. All I'm doing is putting what y'all told me on him. Where does he get all that stuff? They all know I'm in AA. That employer knows I'm in AA. This may be a God thing. The guy that hired me just drank himself out of a $350,000 a year job. I hooked him up with my son and a couple of other people in AA, and he's trying to make it. He's not doing too good, but he may make it. So what I want to tell you about today, since I've last seen you, most of my days have been rather ordinary days. Get up, go to work, go to meetings, share what I've got to share. Don't try to share something I don't have. And those ordinary days for the last 4 years have become monumental events every morning when I wake up. You know, I'm kind of like that guy. I was 70 years old in January, and I'm 28 years sober in this fellowship. There were a couple of Mormon kids traveling throughout the Mississippi Delta, which was a little disadvantage for them to start with. And they were working a canvas in the neighborhood, knocking on doors, handing out leaflets for the Church of the Latter-day Saints, and not having much luck. Finally, about 4 o'clock that afternoon, they knocked on the door, and a drunk came to the door, and you know, hell, we'll talk to anybody. So the drunk said, "Come on in, guys." They came in, sat down around the coffee table, and they sat there and looked at each other for about 5 minutes. Nobody said a word. Finally, the drunk said, "What do we do now?" And they said, "We don't know. We've never gotten this far before." I know exactly how they feel. I've never been this far before. But if the way things are going today are any indication of how they're going to be tomorrow, next month, or next year, they're going to be monumental events in my life. And I owe every bit of it to succumbing to a power greater than myself and trying to align my will with His on a daily basis. I got my deal so simple now. You know, I've got close friends. I've got people in this room that I know practice this on a daily basis. They get up every morning, make that coffee, and do their morning meditation. I got to do it like the book says, upon awakening. I'm laying there flat on my back looking at that ceiling when I do it, because once I get out of that bed, I'm like Louise A. and Nevis. I got one of them grand central minds, man, and I'm off and going again. I do it laying in the bed in the morning. I ask Him one very simple thing. I've distilled it down to this, and it about covers it all. Help me live today in a manner that would be pleasing to You. Give me the strength and the courage to do the tasks that come to me today. Try to treat every person that I encounter on today's journey. I just found out what the legal, I'm still into that. What Webster's definition of journey is one day's travel. Ain't that neat? One day at a time, one day's journey. I ask to try to treat everybody that I run into on a daily basis and look at you. Sometimes you're not performing as well as I think you ought to. But to look at you in this light, that you're doing the very best you can. And when I look at you that way, I don't have any problems. Because I know some days that's all I'm doing is the very best I can. And some days it's real good and some days it's not. I got another little thing that I have, it's come out of the book. It's not necessarily worded the way the book says. It's to give everything that I've got to my marriage, to give everything I've got to my job, to give everything that I've got to Alcoholics Anonymous, to every person, every situation that occurs in my life, and not expect anything in return. Two good things happen to me. Number one, you are absolutely incapable of disappointing me. And number two, when I go to bed at night, I'm going to feel like a pretty good guy. Thank you so much for having me here. God bless you, and keep on doing it.